remove anything at once, and the law does not apply to it.
All right. We're going to have to leave it there now. Robert in Lakesh with those stories. Robert, thank you. And that does it for this London broadcast, everyone.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
While the US president golfed, Americans suffered. People are losing their extended unemployment benefits, said the senator from Vermont. They're going to be evicted from their apartments because the eviction moratorium is ending. Although U.S. Congress has recently approved a compromise relief bill that would have temporarily averted catastrophic expiration of critical unemployment and other benefits, including an extension of the federal eviction moratorium during the deadliest period of the pandemic, Trump declined to sign the measure into law, blasting its $600 direct payments to Americans as a disgrace and calling for $2,000 stimulus checks instead. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Brett Wilkins Ryder. This article is published under the heading Unbelievably Cruel. Sanders slams Trump's intransigence as millions lose unemployment lifeline. Stay tuned for the details of this article. Senator Bernie Sanders on Sunday, December 27th, led progressive lawmakers in condemning President Donald Trump's refusal to approve a $900 billion COVID-19 relief and a spending bill as unemployment coverage expired for millions of Americans on Saturday night, December 26th, as a result of his intransigence. What the president is doing right now is unbelievably cruel, Sanders said during an appearance on ABC's This Week Sunday morning. Many millions of people are losing their extended unemployment benefits. They're going to be evicted from their apartments because the eviction moratorium is ending. Although U.S. Congress has recently approved a compromise relief bill that would have temporarily averted catastrophic expiration of critical unemployment and other benefits, including an extension of the federal eviction moratorium during the deadliest period of the pandemic, Trump declined to sign the measure into law, blasting its $600 direct payments to Americans as a disgrace and calling for $2,000 stimulus checks instead. Representative Rashida Tlaib, one of only two House Democrats to vote against the bill, also called its $600 payment woefully inadequate. I have watched as many of my colleagues rush to provide billions to corporations and wealthy individuals while admonishing the needs of the majority of families, Tlaib explained recently. Republicans continue to do all they can to poison our society further with corporate greed, while abandoning the very people they are supposed to be working for. This is evident by the inclusion of the three lunch tax giveaway, she added, referring to a tax deduction for business meals included in the bill. However, Sanders has argued that the terrible economic crisis facing the U.S. makes action imperative. We're looking at a way to get the vaccine distributed to tens of millions of people, Sanders said, referring to the massive nationwide effort to distribute COVID-19 vaccines. There is money in that bill. Progressive lawmakers from across the U.S. joined Sanders in urging the relief bill's passage. Here we are with people living on the edge as a result of this pandemic, and Trump is playing with their lives and their livelihoods, said Representative Barbara Lee during a Saturday interview on MSNBC. People can't afford to live life on the edge. 8 million more people have fallen below the poverty line. Joe Biden also joined the chorus of bipartisan voices calling on Trump to sign the bill. It is the day after Christmas, and millions of families don't know if they will be able to make ends meet because of President Donald Trump's refusal to sign an economic relief bill approved by Congress with an overwhelming and bipartisan majority, Biden said in a statement on Saturday, December 26. Trump remained defiant following the expiration of jobless benefits. I simply want to get our great people $2,000 rather than the measly $600 that is now in the bill, he tweeted. Also, stop the billions of dollars in pork. While the president golfed, Americans suffered. Lantris Haynes, a self-employed single mother of three in South Bend, Indiana, braced for the loss of her $129 weekly lifeline. It's a chess game and we are all pawns, Haynes told the Associated Press.
Inside Israel.
Subhuman conditions in Israel for foreign workers and migrants. That's according to a report by Israel's Hotline for Refugees and Migrants, NGO. It describes treatment by Israeli authorities of detained migrants akin to torture. Migrants, according to the NGO, are being hit with belts, have lack of contact with the outside world, and receive just moments of free time in the open air in Israel.
14 months you've been in the detention facility in the south of Israel. And 14 months, you make connections, like you said. You are living all day for 14 months with people. And one day, they are seeing you getting out of there. How do they feel about this?
I mean, it is really very sad that being incarcerated there for 14 months. There are a lot of people also for more than that. And there is no any justification at all. They release me without... telling me why, and I'm sure that they gain nothing of incarcerating somebody like me or others who are in Holot right now. There is no gain out of it at all, other than torturing some other human beings.
In one location alone, there are 11,465 detainees, including 370 children and 4,969 women. They are living in subhuman conditions that fail to meet legal standards. A new report by an Israeli human rights group paints a picture of humiliating treatment towards foreign workers and migrants. It shows the extent of unlawful arrest and actual physical violence that they face. The report by the Hotline for Refugees and Migrants for 2019 gathered dozens of testimonies. It revealed shocking incidents at several migrant detention facilities where migrants are detained. The report states that dozens of detainees were imprisoned for months in several detention facilities all across Israel. In fact, according to the report, authorities in these facilities used extreme methods to control the detainees. These methods include beatings with a belt and the forced use of sleeping pills. One such facility is the Yahalom Detention Center. It is located at Ben Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv, the capital. In 2019, it held approximately 11,465 detainees, including 370 children and 4,969 women in subhuman conditions that failed to meet legal standards. Many of the tortured migrants come from Africa and Southeast Asia. Israel's Ynet News cites care worker from the Philippines who worked in Israel for 15 years as saying, "The three of us were locked in a small room, without a TV and without our phones that were confiscated." The report also found that immigration inspectors are now breaking into places of residence by force. Additionally, the report claims that in 2019, there was a sharp increase in the number of deported families. It claims that the actual total number of deportees amounted to 6,694. The data and evidence reveal conduct that violates the High Court's directive and even the immigration authorities' own procedures, according to Sigal Rosen from the Hotline for Refugees and Migrants.
Main trends we identified were detention of those who denied entry to Israel, preventing those who have been denied entry from applying for asylum when they wanted to. There was, again, cases of violence by immigration authority inspectors towards detainees. And in the last year, there was a special problem of detention of families with children, school children, ahead of their deportation from Israel. During the last year, the immigration authority started focusing on efforts to detain school-aged children. This population was previously spared from detention and deportation, but in the last year, the immigration started arresting these children, especially in order to deport them. Unfortunately, the Israeli immigration policy is to allow the immigration of Jews only, and whoever is not Jewish and is not entering to Israel under the law of return, but under the entry to Israel law, the Israeli government is doing whatever in its power to arrest and deport him. Well, if Israel doesn't want non-Jews to live in this country, then they just don't need to bring these people. Right now, and actually anytime, there is more than 100,000 legal migrant workers that the government is initiating their entry into the country. It is not reasonable to invite all these people and then to deport them. And this is already amount to torture. Detaining a migrant who committed no crime just because Israel failed to deport him for such long years without any prospect for release is definitely a torture.
On social media, the conversation was tense. Traf Lab says COVID-19 made the situation of some of the most vulnerable workers worse and introduced some highly restrictive targeted policies that had grave impact on their lives. Hopefully, it also created an opportunity to rethink policies and reassess how to address vulnerabilities. Brin says Israel's crimes include ethnic cleansing, bouts of genocide in Gaza, torture of children, theft of land, targeted killings and murder, house demolitions, and myriads more since the squatter entity was unilaterally declared in Palestine by a Polish immigrant in May 1948.
The facts are that Israel signed the UN Convention on Refugees, which means that they're supposed to give refugees and according to international law, regardless of the convention, but they're supposed to give refugees safe haven if they're leaving from a country where they're in trouble, where they're in danger. And obviously that's not what's really happening on the ground. They face a lot of racism, they face a lot of legal and bureaucratic issues. So on the one hand, on paper, Israel is supposed to be treating them in a different way than what's happening on the ground. Of course, I mean, in any country, when an immigrant or an asylum seeker comes for work or to flee danger, they're obviously at a disadvantage, right? Because of language, because of legal issues, because of all kinds of things, and so it's easy to exploit them. Here, we have a particularly difficult situation because, as I explained, most of the asylum seekers are not getting legal and social help from the government. And so, you know, they need to somehow be able to raise their families, to feed their kids. So if they're, you know, working under the table or working at restaurants and being taken advantage of, the system is sort of set up to do that rather than to help.
Okay, so yes, in general, I think there's a fundamental racist problem in Israel. It has always been an issue in Israel. The targets of the racism have changed. It was either at the beginning, I would say, the Arab population or the Sephardic population, what we call the people that came from north of Africa and Yemen. They suffer from systematic racism towards even from the beginning. And of course, now that we have the Ethiopian Jews that came to Israel 20, 30, 40 years ago, and of course, the asylum seekers coming from Africa, they all suffer from a systematic racist problem in Israel. It's quite unbelievable even. It's heartbreaking. And you can see the results. Actually, the Ethiopian Jews, I was in the trial yesterday of Salomon Taka, a young Jewish Ethiopian boy that was murdered by the police. He was shot by a police officer. We have succeeded to raise awareness, and there's a trial going on, which is quite exceptional. But we know that the trial will not bring anything, and the policeman is not blamed of murdering the boy. He's blamed of, I don't know, some sort of something else. But in general, we have a long list of young Ethiopian boys that are being imprisoned, criminalized, killed. So of course, when it comes to even the Jewish black community, the asylum seekers suffer from it much more. I think basically it stems from the fact that the Jewish community that established, the Zionists that has established Israel, came from Western Europe countries, East European countries. I think they all suffer from racism until today. So basically, I think we brought the racism from Europe to Israel. When you think about the people that established Israel, including my great grandparents and my family from both sides. So I think they came with the notion that anything that is not European is not equal to them. And of course, I think it had to do with the fact that we had to basically, we're committing ethnic cleansing towards the Arab population in that was here in Palestine. So in order to do that, you have to make them subhuman. And I think that, you know, echoes the way we treated the community, the Jewish community that came, as I said, from the northern part of Africa or from Yemen. They received the same treatment. They have been, their culture, their language, everything that they brought with them was valued as less, as not as good as the coming things that came from east of Europe. So basically, I think it's something that's rooted in the Zionists and the Jewish society here in Israel.
The daunting report reveals a sharp increase in the number of immigrant families imprisoned for the purpose of deportation from Israel. And for the first time, it also aimed to detain students. Such torture of migrants is not new. In 2018, the United Nations said that migrants in Israel suffered from abuse and torture before they were ultimately deported. The UN refugee conducted research into the subject and highlighted 80 individual cases of people who risked their lives after they were relocated by Israel and then had to make hazardous journeys to Europe through Libya. The UN said that migrants suffered abuse, torture, and extortion before risking their lives once again by crossing the Mediterranean to Italy after Israel had sent them away. In April 2018, Israel reached an agreement with the United Nations to expel around 16,000 African migrants to Western countries in exchange for granting temporary residency in Israel to the same number. Shortly after, however, the deal was canceled by the Israeli regime.
All these years, actually, since 2013, when Israel started sending asylum seekers to Rwanda and Uganda, only asylum seekers who decided to move to these countries left. No one was taken there by force. It is correct that many of them felt coerced to go there because of the heavy decrees and laws that locked them down in prison, in Cholot, all the economic decrees that took away such a large amount of their salaries and left them with no means to live. The international law brutally when it deals with both asylum seekers and migrant workers. We see in the case of migrant workers that people are detained in illegal condition, not just according to international law, but also according to the Israeli law. And regarding asylum seekers, we see that Israel do not bother to check the asylum claims. Detain them, coerce them to move to other country, and limit their freedom of movement in a way that violates the Refugee Convention.
On social media, the conversation was tense. Suburb says that an Israeli court rules the city to be a white city and that schools for blacks or funding transport for black school children to attend school elsewhere are liable to alter the city's demographic balance. This could incentivize blacks to move into the city, damaging its white character. Fatima says that the crimes that are happening all over the world against the oppressed Yemenis, Palestinians, Afghans, Indians, Chinese, blacks, etc. are being planned by the United States and Israel. The international community must protest against these atrocities. Ali says the extinction of insects and reptiles is important to the United Nations.
And there are different types of immigrants in Israel. There are migrant workers and there are asylum seekers, as I said. But it's very, very difficult to naturalize in Israel if you're not coming and making aliyah, if you're not coming as a Jew from a different country and trying to live here permanently, it's nearly impossible to naturalize here, including if you're an immigrant, a non-Jewish immigrant that wants to marry or marries outside of the country a citizen. So there's a lot of bureaucracy, and the legal system is not set up to help migrant workers and refugees, and this is why they're a vulnerable community in Israel. And so, you know, even things like getting social services during a global pandemic, as I said, the deposit law was canceled, but there are lots of other issues and social benefits that other people living here, citizens mainly, are receiving that these people are not receiving because they're not really recognized.
And I'm here in order to make a change. We have a prime minister who's divisive, who is splitting the country, who is ruining our economy, and who is undermining the structure of democracy.
I'm coming here to protest for 6 months because our prime minister has he's criminal, and he's kind of dictator, and we want him out.
Basically, Israel does not respect any international law. Neither it doesn't respect the international law, the asylum, the refugee convention, the Geneva Convention. Sorry, it has never been committed to anything in the Geneva Convention regarding asylum seekers, regarding refugees. But it also does the same thing towards the Palestinians. There are no international laws, none whatsoever, that Israel respects. Even the deportation, they found a system with these third countries. I call them the revolving door, Rwanda and Uganda, which they did not even allow to say their name in courts. By the way, I went to Uganda, and we also had connections with parliament members of Uganda. That's one of the reasons that his program has failed. We collected testimonies, and we know that Israel has done everything it's in its power to either walk around these international laws or disregard them in general. I would even say that the Supreme Court of Israel itself does not respect the international law. It doesn't say so out front, but it definitely does everything in its power to override these international laws. Public pressure create a change? No. Public pressure, if it's not, governments cannot create a change, okay? The whole BDS movement, which basically Israel is very worried by it, cannot really create change because we're not talking about governments. We're talking about private people, NGOs, or whatever. If the only way, I think, basically, if you ask me, and this is what we have worked towards with 2018, when we were hoping that the deal with the UN would go through. Israel will never accept its small amount of asylum seekers. We're talking about less than 30,000 asylum seekers that are even not called asylum seekers. They're called infiltrators. They're called infiltrators by the Supreme Court. No, these people will never receive fair treatment. They will never be considered human beings, basically.
The migrants that have been tortured include workers that have been working in Israel for decades. They are cheap labor and working conditions that Israeli employees do not. They do not receive any incentives or benefits. In fact, many of them do not see their paychecks in years. Israel has been allowing this to go on for decades. To many of these migrants and laborers, they are being treated as modern-day slaves. Israel has promised them savings forcefully cut from their paychecks if they leave. Israel has been wanting them to leave for years. Now it is executing mass imprisonment of this minority group of people. It remains to be seen what actions the UN will take after the latest torture report in Israel. Here is the news making the press in Israel. The Jerusalem Post. The father of Facebook Israel CEO and an active protester against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was killed after being struck by a car during an anti-Netanyahu protest at the entrance of the city of Sabion. Police ruled out any intention to harm by the driver, a woman in her 20s. The Times of Israel. Hackers published sensitive client information stolen from Sherbet Insurance after the company refused on Friday to pay the approximately $1 million ransom demanded. The group responsible for the attack, Black Shadow, had said that if the requested sum of now 200 bitcoins was transferred into its account, it would not publish or sell the information. I-24 News. Amir Peretz, Israel's economy minister and head of the Labor Party, announced that he will be running for Israel's presidency in 2021. Peretz, who was the military minister during the 2006 Second Lebanon War, made the announcement in an interview with Army Radio. Israel's current president, Reuven Rivlin, is set to step down in mid-2021, with the Knesset, Israeli parliament, tasked with electing the next president. Ynet News. Two Israeli teenagers have been arrested on suspicion of sexually abusing two small children over a period of 2 years, the police said. According to the police, some of the abuses of the children, aged 4 and 7, took place inside a local synagogue. During the covert probe, the investigators gathered findings and collected evidence from several children, which helped them to uncover the affair.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech of Ayatollah Khamenei delivered on January 8, 2020, in a meeting with the people of the city of Qom. The meeting was held on the anniversary of an uprising led by the people of the city of Qom on January 9, 1978.
Shahid Soleimani would embrace danger, and he had no fears. His courage showed itself not only in recent events, but also during the Sacred Defense era, during which time he was the commander of the Tharallah army. Both he and his army showed exemplary courage, and he was a man of wisdom as well. He would think carefully, and he had reasons for his actions. This simultaneous courage and acumen manifested itself not only in the arena of the military, but also in the arena of politics. I said this many times to the friends active in the arena of politics, as we were witness to his behavior and his actions. He was courageous and wise in the arena of politics as well. His words would exert tremendous influence, and they were convincing. Above all, he was pure and sincere. He would expend his courage and acumen on the path of God, and he was not a hypocrite and a pretentious man.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, my Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger than the good.
Lord, let anyone
Sincerity is very important. We should practice sincerity as well. Another one of his qualities was that despite being a commander who had mastery over the military, he was very careful to observe Shari'i principles. Sometimes, people forget about Shari'i principles in the arena of war, saying that there's no time for that, but he was very careful in this regard. He would not use weapons if he did not deem it necessary. He would take care not to transgress against other people's rights. He would exercise caution in areas that people do not deem necessary, but he would try to be cautious. He would embrace danger, but at the same time, he would protect others' lives as far as he could. He would watch over the lives of his comrades, his soldiers, and his colleagues from among other nations who stood beside him.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
In the limelight.
U.S. President Donald Trump suffered fresh humiliation on Monday when more than 100 Republicans joined Democrats in the House of Representatives to override his veto of a $741 billion defense bill. If, as expected, the Senate follows suit later this week, it will be Congress's first such rebuke of his presidency, which has only 3 weeks left to run. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist David Smith. The piece is titled, House Republicans Join with Democrats to Override Trump's Veto of Defense Bill. Stay with us for more of David Smith's article. U.S. President Donald Trump suffered fresh humiliation on Monday when more than 100 Republicans joined Democrats in the House of Representatives to override his veto of a $741 billion defense bill. If, as expected, the Senate follows suit later this week, it will be Congress's first such rebuke of his presidency, which has only 3 weeks left to run. During a high-stakes day on Capitol Hill, the democratically controlled House of Representatives also voted to boost coronavirus relief payments to $2,000 per person. This was a step endorsed by Donald Trump, but is thought unlikely to progress in the Senate. The National Defense Authorization Act, which funds service members' pay, oversees military operations and other needs, has been passed by Congress every year since 1967. Donald Trump exercised his veto last week, returning the bill with objections, including its proposal to change the names of 10 military bases honoring Confederate leaders. Donald Trump was also aggrieved that the legislation did not repeal Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which protects technology companies from legal liability over content posted by their users. The president has accused Facebook and Twitter of political bias against him. Donald Trump's objections served as the latest loyalty test for Republicans in the aftermath of his election defeat by Joe Biden. Kevin McCarthy, the House Minority Leader, announced that he would not vote to override Donald Trump's veto despite supporting the original bill, which passed both chambers of Congress with strong bipartisan backing. But it was not enough. Some 109 Republicans broke with Donald Trump on Monday and joined Democrats to support the bill. The final tally of 322-87 comfortably reached the two-thirds threshold required to override President Donald Trump's veto. Mac Thornberry, the most senior Republican in the House of Representatives Armed Services Committee, urged his colleagues who had supported the bill earlier this month to back it again. "It's the exact same bill. Not a comma has changed," he said. "I would only ask that as members vote, they put the best interests of the country first. There is no other consideration that should matter." Democrat Adam Smith, chair of the committee, said, "It is enormously important that we pass this bill. We did it once, let's just do it one more time, and then we can all go home for the year. We can be done, and we can be proud of what we have accomplished." The defense bill is expected to go before the Republican-controlled Senate later this week. It will become law if passed with a two-thirds majority. Donald Trump has exercised the veto 9 times during his presidency, but this would be the first override by Congress. Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, expressed gratitude that Trump's dangerous sabotage efforts had been thwarted. "The president must end his 11th-hour campaign of chaos and stop using his final moments in office to obstruct bipartisan and bicameral action to protect our military and defend our security," Nancy Pelosi said. But activists found little consolation in the Republican defiance. Mary Small, Indivisible's acting national policy director, said, "This is no cause for celebration. It's sad and infuriating that the only time Republicans banded together to rebuke Donald Trump was in pursuit of an over-militarized foreign policy and bloated defense budget, and not any of the other horrifying, democracy-destroying, cruel things that he has done." Donald Trump blindsided Republicans again last week when he initially refused to sign a $2.3 trillion government funding and coronavirus relief package that had taken Congress months to negotiate. Trump eventually relented on Sunday night at his Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida, averting a government shutdown. Donald Trump had demanded direct stimulus payments to U.S. citizens be increased to $2,000 as opposed to the agreed $600. On Monday, the House of Representatives voted 275-134 in favor of the higher sum, with 44 Republicans joining Democrats. But it is not certain whether it will even be taken up by the Senate, where again many Republicans would find themselves in the uncomfortable position of crossing Donald Trump. Bernie Sanders, an independent senator from Vermont, said, "The House has passed a $2,000 direct payment for working people. It is time for the Senate to act. This week on the Senate floor, Mitch McConnell wants to vote to override Trump's veto of the $740 billion defense funding bill and then head home for the new year. I'm going to object until we get a vote on legislation to provide a $2,000 direct payment to the working class." Bernie Sanders, a former candidate in the Democratic presidential primary, added, "Let me be clear, if Senator Mitch McConnell doesn't agree to an up or down vote to provide the working people of our country a $2,000 direct payment, Congress will not be going home for New Year's Eve. Let's do our job.
General Qasem Soleimani was a high-ranking Iranian military official whose popularity began to rise after he led the war on Daesh terrorists on the battlefields in Syria and Iraq. General Qasem Soleimani was the commander of Iran's Quds Force, the foreign arm of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. He was of great help to Syria as an advisor and organizer of Syrian troops when Daesh and other Takfiri terrorists launched a bloody assault on Syria in 2011. He also played a key role in creating Iraq's Popular Mobilization Unit, also known as Hashd al-Shaabi, in 2014, when Daesh declared its caliphate in Iraq and overran several provinces there. Hashd al-Shaabi later managed to defeat Daesh and drive the terrorist group out of Iraq. These victories for Syrian and Iraqi forces further increased General Soleimani's popularity among the Iraqis, Syrians, and Iranians. When General Soleimani declared the end of the Daesh Caliphate in 2018, the United States, which called itself the savior of the Iraqi and Syrian people, described him as its arch enemy and an obstacle to peace in the Middle East. The U.S. imposed sanctions on Soleimani. The Israeli regime also put Soleimani on its so-called terror list. In the year 2020, the assassination of General Soleimani and Hashd al-Shaabi's commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in a U.S. drone strike raises a key question. Was the United States really fighting Daesh? Or as U.S. President Donald Trump himself has said, was Daesh created by his predecessor Barack Obama? Perhaps now it would be easier to answer this question after the assassination of General Soleimani. What is clear is that the United States has killed a man who played the biggest role in both eliminating Daesh from the region and isolating Washington. Following this terrorist attack and the martyrdom of a group of people who had fought Daesh and other Takfiri terrorists round the clock, the question is, who really wants peace and stability in the region? And who is after igniting a war to plunder the Middle East?
Around the World with Reporters.
The Israeli regime has been intensifying its moves in the region as media revelations suggest it is intending to build a military base on the Yemeni island of Socotra. Yemen's Supreme Political Council has condemned these suspicious moves, promising Israel a decisive response in case it commits any stupidity against the Yemenis.
The Israeli move is not new, as it is running the region through some puppet regimes. The Yemeni position is clear as it was 6 years ago. We are in the midst of a war launched by Saudi Arabia with the tacit backing of American and Zionist regimes.
The Israeli media have boasted the arrival of the submarine to the Bab al-Mandab Strait after crossing the Suez Canal. An Israeli military spokesman also confirmed the move, claiming the step was taken to counter smart drones Iran could potentially launch from Yemen or Iraq.
The presence of Israeli entities in the Yemen territorial waters dates back to the beginning of the Saudi-led aggression. It was just a year ago. There were plenty of statements by some Arab rulers pledging to stop what they claimed the Iranian expansion in the region. However, the same rulers are silent on the Israeli agenda. They have not only normalized their ties with the regime, but allow its submarines pass through the Red Sea.
It seems that the Yemeni army's possession of missile systems capable of reaching as far as Eilat has become become a nightmare for Israel and its cronies. Tel Aviv knows that it will not be immune to the Yemeni retaliation. However, sending one of its submarines is yet another provocative move by Israel to set the region on fire.
Israel is still using Iran as a pretext for its interventions in the region, that despite the exposure of its agenda, especially in Yemen, which is suffering from a war led by Saudi Arabia, but was actually jointly hatched by some Arab regimes and their backers in Washington and Tel Aviv. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have expressed gratitude to Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani 1 year after his assassination by U.S. forces in the Iraqi capital Baghdad. Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani played a major role in strengthening Palestinian resistance movements against the Israeli regime.
We commemorate the first anniversary of the martyrdom of the great commander Haj Qasem Soleimani, who died for the sake of Jerusalem al-Quds. This anniversary comes amid great pressures on the resistance in the region. On this occasion, we vow to follow in the footsteps of the commander to liberate Palestine.
Following the assassination of General Soleimani, Palestinians held several events to pay tribute to the late Iranian commander. They considered him as a hero for Palestine and Jerusalem al-Quds.
On the anniversary of the martyrdom of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, we express our great gratitude for sacrifices he made for the sake of oppressed Palestinians.
The assassination of General Soleimani on Donald Trump's orders has sent shockwaves across the West Asia. Soleimani's memory continues to live in the hearts and minds of Palestinians in the blockaded Gaza Strip.
Palestinians will continue to remain steadfast and condemn the treason by some Arab countries that have normalized ties with the Zionist regime. On this occasion, Palestinians also vow to fight the occupation until regaining their freedom.
Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was assassinated in a U.S. airstrike on January 3rd.
Palestinians say martyr Qasem Soleimani has sacrificed his life for the sake of Palestine and Jerusalem al-Quds and has always supported Palestinian resistance against the Zionist regime. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Ahead of the first anniversary of the assassination of the former commander of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, General Qasem Soleimani, people are now holding commemoration ceremonies to pay respect to this late Iranian icon. We went to the city of Qom, where a movement called Resistance Youth Front is formed to support the cause of General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, who defeated the ominous phenomenon of Daesh. Scholars, youth, activists, and resistance movement supporters from countries like Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and India attended the ceremony to tell the world that General Soleimani's cause will not be forgotten.
It's a great pleasure for all of us, for all the people of the world who are free, who just think freely, okay? So such kind of attribution actually led us to not only memorize or recall their memory, actually also to follow their path. That is the path of humanity. That is the real war on terror, war against terror.
Shahid Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, they fight for saving the life of all mankind, of all Muslim and non-Muslim.
General Qasem Soleimani was assassinated by a U.S. strike on January 3rd last year when he was on an official visit to the Iraqi capital Baghdad. Hitting his convoy, the assault also led to the death of many others, including Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, deputy commander of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Units, or Hashd al-Shaabi. Apart from this ceremony held here, within the coming days, a number of other events will be held across Iran under health protocols to pay tribute to General Qasem Soleimani. Human Abedi, Qom.
Afghans are a nation with a long history of resistance against various enemies. Since 19th century, Afghanistan has been invaded by different armies. The colonial army of Britain, the Red Army of the Soviet Union and the Black Army of Terrorism, along with its international backers. They all tried to break the will of Afghans. As experts say, the existence of a resistance spirit among Afghans has helped them to make contacts with other resistance figures beyond the Afghan borders. Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was one such figure who was interested in having ties with anti-terrorism and anti-hegemony resistance movements, mainly across the Middle East and some other Asian countries, including Afghanistan.
Lieutenant General Soleimani was popular in many societies like Afghanistan. He was a charismatic leader who fought terrorism and helped many oppressed nations to strongly stand against terrorism.
Many others also believe that the charismatic personality of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani revives for Afghans the memory of Afghanistan's national hero, Ahmad Shah Massoud. It becomes more interesting when you understand that both Soleimani and Massoud had friendly ties before Massoud's assassination, only 2 days ahead of the 9/11 attacks.
Lieutenant General Soleimani had a transnational personality. He had close ties and cooperation with our national hero Ahmad Shah Massoud and Professor Rabbani, who were leading anti-terrorism resistance in northern Afghanistan.
Let's not forget that many here in Afghanistan believe the slaying of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, who was leading regional resistance against terrorists, is not an endpoint in the fight against terror. Rather, his assassination has made the resistance front all the more determined in its campaign against terrorists. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The first person vaccinated against COVID-19 in Austria, an 84-year-old pensioner who says she wants to see her children, grandchildren and great-grandchildren again without hesitation. The first 5 volunteers who received the initial doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine included 3 elderly patients with underlying health conditions and 2 healthcare personnel. According to the manufacturer, a certain protective effect should already exist 7 days after the first of the 2 doses is injected. Chancellor Sebastian Kurz and Health Minister Rudolf Anschober, who were present for the vaccinations at Vienna's Medical University, spoke of a historic day.
This is the beginning of the victory against a pandemic and a game changer. We move to normalcy step by step with every vaccination that is carried out.
But the two officials warned of challenging months ahead.
Today marks a turning point, but the fight against the coronavirus has not yet been won.
Anschober said that by the summer, over 4 million doses of the vaccine would be available in Austria, which has a population of almost 9 million. The vaccination is expected to be rolled out in 3 phases, starting with those in high-risk groups, over 80-year-olds and medical personnel in the first few weeks of January, and continuing with frontline workers. And from April, the rest of the population, excluding those under the age of 16. Austria entered into its 3rd hard lockdown on Saturday, with the Chancellor warning against a 3rd corona wave and a massive increase in infection numbers across Europe.
Officials have made it clear that another year of recurring lockdowns is not an option. The hope is that with more vaccinations, that can be avoided. Homa Leski, Vienna.
On International Day of Epidemic Preparedness, Gaza's health sector continues to suffer due to the Israeli blockade. Coronavirus infections have skyrocketed in the Gaza Strip, which is one of the world's most densely populated areas. Despite the increasing number of COVID-19 infections, the Israeli regime continues to place tight restrictions on the entry of humanitarian supplies, including medicines and hospital equipment. Human rights organizations say Israel's illegal practices have compounded the risk of coronavirus infection for nearly 2 million Palestinians, making it extremely difficult to combat the deadly pandemic.
The Israeli blockade has taken its toll on all aspects of life in Gaza, and especially on the health sector.
The health sector is suffering from an unprecedented deterioration due to lack of medicines and medical supplies, as well as trained medical personnel